Welcome back to My Seminary Life. I'm your host, Brandon Knight, and today we are heading on a trip. We're going on a trip out west, or at least west of my location, to Bundyville. Here on My Seminary Life, I like to talk about the things that I have been studying recently. Started out as a show talking about my journey through seminary, working on my master's degree. Anymore now that I've graduated, this is a show dedicated to me just being a lifelong student and seeking out different ways to learn and to grow. And one of those ways that I do that now is by listening to podcasts. And if you've been hanging out with me throughout this year, back in January, which I know January feels like it was about 17 years ago now, but back in January, I did an episode, two episodes really, on an NPR podcast series called Extremely American. Two seasons. I really focused more on season two, because in season two, it was all about Doug Wilson and his Christian nationalistic machine, this like move, the trying to understand the Christian nationalism movement within America, particularly through Doug Wilson, who in a way has become like the guy, the godfather of Christian nationalism. And in the second episode, I then spent time talking about how I would define and systematize Christian nationalism into two kind of camps. If you haven't listened to those two episodes, I encourage you to go back and check them out and to listen to the NPR podcast series, because it is very good. Now, I didn't talk much about season one of Extremely American, and that's because though it was very interesting and definitely worth going to listen to if the topic interests you, or don't skip season one just to do season two, listen to both. The seasons aren't that long. Season one focused more on alt-right militia groups, and it's a very interesting and very important topic, but I had a hard time figuring out how to connect that to what I do here on My Seminary Life. It was interesting, but I wasn't really sure how to connect season one into an episode that would make sense to the audience. Not that the audience here on the show is dumb. It's just, you know, we have a specific lane that I try to stay in sometimes. It's a very wide lane because I like to talk about a lot of different things. But talking about Christian nationalism is a little bit more of a relevant, significant topic to this audience and to myself, and was the main reason why I listened to Extremely American. But I did listen to season one as well, and it's very interesting learning about these alt-right militia groups that are everywhere and also very popular, once again, you guessed it, out west, in west of me. I'll just have to keep saying that. I'm in the Midwest. For those of you who don't know, I'm in the Midwest, so everything is either west or east of me at this point. Yeah, that's how directions work, Brandon. I have a master's degree. That was the dumbest comment I've ever made in my life. Anyway, so in season one, talking about these alt-right militia groups that are everywhere, but also have a bit of a stronghold, again, out west of me in that, like, Idaho region. I know Idaho has really built itself up as, like, this. A lot of the states going towards the west have kind of built themselves into this, like, caricature of there being not much but a Buc-ee's. That's basically all that there is out there. Each state has a Buc-ee's, and that's about it. But politically speaking, especially for what's going on right now, Idaho and other, as we'll get into here in a moment with Bundyville, other western but not coastal western states are actually proving to be very important battlegrounds or even strongholds for some very important things that we need to know about. Now, in one of the episodes of season one of Extremely American, I apologize, I don't remember which one exactly, the host was talking about this very specific event that militia groups showed up to help out at. And it was really fascinating. And he interviewed one of the people who like showed up that day as kind of an independent person to, but also to like help alongside the militias. And talked about this very interesting event. And the host said, you know, I'm kind of doing more of a surface level because there's a lot to cover in this series. So if you want to go deeper into this event, check out the podcast series Bundyville. And I said, okay, cool. So I went, found it, you know, saved it so that way I could come back to it later. And this was just intended to be like something for myself. Again, it's within this season one, so I'm like, there's not anything that's gonna probably come up that's like directly related to stuff that I talk about on MSL. This will just be for my own listening pleasure. And by the time I finished the series, I actually had about 5 episodes worth of material to talk to you all about. So now you get to hear about it. Oh my gosh. So first and foremost, I must give credit to where credit is due. This roundup of episodes I'm doing here is all inspired by this podcast series called Bundyville. And that's the first season. Season two is called Bundyville, The Remnant. And it is in the description of this episode and will be in the subsequent episodes that come up over the next few weeks. And so if you are listening to this, I really do ask you, please check out this podcast series, because just like Extremely American, I'm only going to talk about some surface level things and some very specific important topics that are relevant to the MSL audience. But the whole story, and that which is season one, and then the spin-off adventures, to use a maybe too flippant of a way to describe it, in season two is just so fascinating. There is twist and turns all throughout this story, and the spin-off investigation that comes up in the second season, it's wild. And the things that are going to come up over these next few weeks here on MSL, inspired by this series, are some of those twists and turns, and it gets rather religious. I'm sorry, did I say religious? My bad. I meant the word cultish. Yeah, that's why we're here today, folks. What was supposed to be just like me diving into a fairly recent story that I didn't know much about, just to kind of like further my understanding of this militia group, suddenly turned into an investigation into one of my favorite subjects and some of y'all's favorite subjects too. The reason why some of y'all tune in to my seminary life, because you're just hoping that it's once again Brandon talking about cults. And especially for today's episode, it's cult time, baby. We're going straight into fringe cult stuff. This is some exciting good stuff. If you like cult material, this is some exciting good stuff. Now, like I said, this is basically going to spin off into its own like series worth of episodes. And so over these next few weeks, I'm also going to put this out there. Host of Bundyville, Leah Satilli, if you got the time, you're more than welcome to come on the show and also talk about this, because I feel like I could talk about this all day. This is probably one of my favorite limited series podcasts. I've really come to realize that limited series shows are kind of like my favorite ones, also because there's there's an end to the relationship. Sorry to literally all of my friends, because none of my podcast buddies have limited series. They're all ongoing. I only do ongoing series, so I don't even like my own shows. But I prefer this to my own shows, I could say. But Leah Satilli, if you somehow happen to come across one of these episodes, just know it's an open invite. Email seminarylife@gmail.com. Again, email seminarylife@gmail.com. Would love to have you on the show to talk all things Bundyville. So, Bundyville is not a place, technically. It's a ranch, okay? It is a place out in the, like, Utah. Basically, if you need to picture where things are happening, and I may have just buried the lead a little bit there, but it's Utah November? I promise I haven't been drinking. No, it is the Utah-Nevada area that we're thinking about here as we're going into our trip. No, Bundyville is not specifically like an actual town as much as it is a family. The Bundys. No relation whatsoever to Ted. And in the, I want to say it was the 2010s or so, there was a standoff between the Bundys, the militia, and the FDA, Federal Bureau of Drugs and Alcohol, whatever that one is. That one, okay? The TVA, like in the TVA, like in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. There was a standoff between the Bundys, the militias, some militias, and the U.S. government over grazing fees. So, yeah, I know this is this is not where you thought this was going to go. But basically, the Bundys lived in this area, do live in this area that is by protected lands. We're out west after all, right? And there, once upon a time, you could let your animals graze wherever. However, because a certain species of, I think it was lizards, started to go extinct towards the extinction side of things out west, the government passed laws to protect certain lands in order to protect these critters going around, because we don't want to just like unalive animals for no reason. The Bundys, though, basically claimed eminent domain over this land because they claim that they have been there longer than the government has been around in that state, which is a debated topic that comes up later on in the series. So just plant that in your head for now. Okay. Again, you're getting like the surface level version of the story. Go listen to the whole series. This results in like a decade long worth of grazing fees that the Bundys did not pay off. And it turns into this whole big brouhaha, which is the part that got picked up in the Extremely American episode as well. Because part of it is there was like a sniper on a bridge trying to keep people from getting to a certain location. It's a whole mess. It's a whole heap of trouble over grazing fees. And you might be thinking, but like, why? Like, why go to so much trouble over where your animals could or could not legally graze? Why go to so much trouble? So there's a few threads here that do answer that question, or at least moves us in the direction of why raise such a fuss that it turns into an armed standoff over cattle, which, by the way, the Bundys did get their cattle back and, by the way, have won every or any court case that's been brought against them for their, for them committing a crime. They have won their court cases. So why is this a thing? Part of it comes down to a very important part of militia thinking. A big part of militia thinking, this is, I would say there's like 1, 2, 3 threads that we can follow here that kind of help explain things. One of them is thread number one comes from the militia mindset. And that is this idea that militias, people who are in militias are like the only people in the country who actually know how to interpret the Constitution correctly. That is a big part of the militia mindset, is that not only are they defending the Constitution by doing what they're doing and training for what they're training for, they're also the only ones who know how to adequately interpret what the Constitution says. You know, the thing the Supreme Court is supposed to be doing. Some dude from the middle of nowhere knows better than the Supreme Court justices. Now, what's funny, of course, is the fact that although they know how to accurately interpret the Constitution better than anyone, there are certain aspects of it that also gets interpreted differently depending on the individual. It's almost like older documents need to be revised every once in a while. So not only do the Bundys think that they are the only ones who can interpret the Constitution correctly, still within this thread, that one of their very important political views is the concept of sovereign citizenship, which essentially means that every individual in the United States is their own sovereign country, essentially. And as such, you appeal to the Constitution and you do appeal to your local state government, but the overarching government of the United States is an overreach of the sovereign citizen mentality. It has something to do with the state rights, the concept of state rights, that you're still a citizen of your state, but you're also a sovereign individual, but the overarching government of the United States is an illegal overarching. They cannot override states' rights and sovereign citizenship. It is in a way, because I did do some work on this in previous series, it is in a way similar to what was going on with the Greek city-states. Not so much the sovereign citizen part, but the fact that, like, basically Athens and Sparta and the other Greek city-states were essentially that. They were independent states, but still a part of Greece, but they were still, until Alexander the Great unites everything, like, they are still essentially their own government before they get unified, essentially. That's kind of the idea here with, like, their view on states' rights. The sovereign citizen part is a fairly debunked political view by Constitution scholars. That's thread number one. So basically, who is the U.S. government to say that these lands are protected and you have to pay us grazing fees? They did very strictly paid grazing fees, but they always sent it to the state, who was like, you don't pay us this. But that's who they appealed to, was their local state government and not the government of the overarching government of the United States. Thread number two actually is an event that in a way has absolutely nothing to do with these people, but 30 years later, 30 plus years later, we're beginning to see more and more within this movement, particularly the alt-right militia movement, that Waco was seriously, seriously a game changer. Waco, and also by extension, the Oklahoma City bombing, are crucial events within the past 30 years of 30-ish plus years of American history that I think now we're just beginning to see more and more how significant these two events, especially Waco, plays in the current political theater of the militia mindset. A big part of the militia movement and the bug out movement, which is kind of similar but different, related kind of cousin to the militia movement, is that it's a big skepticism towards the American government, especially when a Democrat is in charge in the White House. When this series was recorded, they were big fans of Donald Trump. This kind of comes up a little bit in season two, but Barack Obama, not that guy, not a fan. And don't you dare imply that it's a race thing for the reason why that they don't like Barack Obama. It's just that he's not sticking to the Constitution, but Donald Trump, he definitely sticks to the Constitution. Granted, that was all back like 2020 when some of these conversations were recorded, or 22 or so. So still like within a time frame where people may have liked Donald Trump a little bit more. Obviously, he's still a pretty popular guy, but nowhere near. I'm recording this post Easter Trump being Jesus AI image, or a Red Cross doctor, whatever it was that he claimed that he was. So I know his popularity, even among MAGA people, have suddenly dropped, but there are still people who really like the guy. Anyway, so a big part of this is Waco, okay? A big part of the militia bug out movement is a skepticism against the U.S. government. And in a way, I don't blame them. I saw something recently that it was more of like an internet thing than like actual data, but that young millennials and Gen Zers are certain groups of Gen Zers are becoming more and more like older generations who were like very skeptical towards the government. And yeah, I can also like definitely agree with that. I'm sitting in an uncomfortable place trying to not get more political, but just to kind of understand some of the political side of things. And yeah, the more I try to understand what's going on, the more I really don't like any of it. So like, yeah, the militia is like, I get it. It's like this skepticism towards the U.S. government. There are moments, I will level with you all, there are moments when either in Extremely American or Bundyville, when they're talking about the militia stuff, then I'm like, you know, you got a bit of a point there, though, with that guy. How they're carrying it out is a completely different story. But some of the like postures and the opinions of the group, of the various groups, I'm like, okay, yeah, either I kind of agree with you, or I at least don't blame you for arriving at that conclusion. And that's where Waco fits in, because Waco is one of the big ones. There are other events that are covered in the Bundyville series, but Waco is one of the unifying events that basically serves as a scapegoat. It is, you think you can trust the government? Look what they did at Waco. Look what they did to the Branch Davidians. The U.S. government didn't protect their religious liberty. No, they killed the majority of the Branch Davidians. Obviously, the Davidians were also stockpiling illegal weapons, and David Koresh was a bad dude. He was a bad mamma jamma. I'm bringing that back. But that's almost irrelevant, because this event, and others as well, that I plan on diving into a bit more, so who knows, we might be coming back to this later as well. Waco serves as a moment for U.S. citizens as a whole, but the militia movement, to be able to say, how much am I willing to trust these people? The government, that is. Because you can spin Waco a couple different directions, and don't get me wrong, I've done research into the Davidians situation, and there's some wonky theology, and again, David Koresh was a bad mamma jamma, but also the U.S. government botched it. They dropped the ball with this situation. So part of it, so one thread is that militia mindset of, we're the ones who can interpret the Constitution correctly. were sovereign citizens of our state. The other thread is examples where the U.S. government either overreached or definitely didn't handle a situation very well, like Waco, like Ruby Ridge is another one that's going to come up and is probably going to be the next one I really look into because I'm not as familiar with Ruby Ridge as I am with Waco. But then there's the third thread. And no, the Waco part wasn't the cult stuff. No, this is the White Horse Prophecy. Oh, what's the White Horse Prophecy? You've never heard of the White Horse Prophecy? Neither did I until I listened to Bundyville. But strap in, folks. It's time to check back in with our good friends, the Mormons. When this came up in the Bundyville series, that's when I said, okay, yeah, I'm going to have to at least talk about this on the show at some point because this is interesting. So, the Mormons. What can be said about the Mormons that hasn't already been said, even by me here on this show? Well, in the movie The Heretic, starring the overwhelmingly charming Hugh Grant, is he ever not charming, folks? There, if you haven't seen the movie The Heretic, or it might just be Heretic, now that I think about it. If you haven't seen the movie Heretic, basically, there's a whole underlying, or there's this whole plot revolving around Mormonism. It's all about Mormonism. And Hugh Grant explains Mormonism in the, I know, a horror movie starring Hugh Grant about Mormonism wasn't also a movie I thought I was going to love, but boy howdy, that's a good one, folks. Hugh Grant describes Mormonism as a regional spinoff. He's looking at the different versions. He's got different versions of Monopoly out on a table. And there's like the original version of Monopoly that was like actually a game that was supposed to teach kids about the evils of capitalism. And then there was how it got translated into the game that we know proper. And then there's like other additions, and then you get like the fun versions that are like, you know, Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, that kind of thing. And he compares that to religion, that there was a religion at one point that a group took and kind of made it their own, and then subsequent revisions, and then you get like the spin-off versions that are like the fun character versions, and that's Mormonism. In his view in the movie, I'm not saying that's accurate, but it's actually kind of a cool metaphor. I kind of liked it in the context of the film, at least. I don't know if it necessarily holds up in like the world religions courtroom class, world religion class, but like I get what they're going for here. Now, although I am an amateur at the history of Mormonism, one of the most interesting parts about Mormonism with this history is that Mormonism has become, within the United States, like the American religion. Not that we're all Mormons, but like this is a very American-made religion. This is a very American-made cult. Yeah, there are others, of course. We've had countless now because of the internet, but like the big three, four. We'll go to the big four would be something along the lines of like Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, NXIVM, though that one's defunct now, and Scientology. You know, that's like the big four American new religious movements within our country that has spread worldwide. Not so much NXIVM now, but at least Latter-day Saints, Jehovah's Witnesses, and Scientology, right? There's been other movements that have come and gone, but that's like the big three that has maintained a religious following, right? The interesting thing, though, about Mormonism is that although it may be an extremely American, wink, religion, it didn't start out that way. Like, Mormons were traveled all around because their theology and way of life was like not tolerated by the states. They moved into what eventually became Utah, because it wasn't a state until they like literally moved there, then it became one. Like, they were persecuted from state to state wherever they went because of their religious views and lifestyle and other factors as well. Don't want to completely paint them as martyrs, but they were persecuted by the U.S. government. And it's wild that they went from the persecuted to, in a way, the like face of American conservatism within a certain pocket of the United States. Like, evangelicalism probably still holds that mark first and foremost, but conservative, and in some cases fundamental, but conservative Mormonism is like a big part of American religious culture. I mean, we're all really obsessed with dirty sodas right now because of the freaking Secret Lives of Mormon Wives show. Like, we're all really into some Mormon thing, even if we may not necessarily realize it. And it's just wild to me that now Mormonism is like such a staple part of America, and yet at one point in time the government almost whacked them all, right? And it that also kind of contributes a little bit to that thinking, thread number two, of, hey, again, the United States government wasn't protecting their religious freedom, instead persecuting them. Just saying, it's an onion. It's an onion. It's an ogre. It's got layers, folks. But the White Horse Prophecy was stated by Joseph Smith that at one point in the future, the U.S. Constitution was going to be hanging by a thread, and it was going to be this uprising of Mormons who were going to be the ones to defend the Constitution and essentially defend the Constitution and then become like the government of the United States. They are the saviors of the United States in the White Horse Prophecy. What's fascinating, in addition to all of that, about the White Horse Prophecy is that Joseph Smith didn't say that. There is no concrete evidence, recorded documents, nothing that solidifies the fact that Joseph Smith said this, or any of the original like prophets of Mormonism. There's nothing. There is actually no recorded evidence that Joseph Smith said the White Horse Prophecy. And that is very important, obviously, but for maybe a reason you don't realize, because Mormons love their history. Mormon historical scholarship is like a big thing in their circles. They love like discovering documents and really like understanding their history. If you haven't seen the Netflix docuseries, I love this series. I should rewatch it and do a whole thing here on the show at some point. But the series Murder Among the Mormons is about this. It's about like their love for their history. And so, although I might not agree with the Mormons on a lot of things, if Mormon historians are saying that there is no concrete evidence whatsoever, no recorded documentation at all, that Joseph Smith prophesied the White Horse Prophecy, to tell you the truth, folks, I'm going to take their word for it. But even though there is not, even though the White Horse Prophecy is not one of the official prophecies of the church, it has, to a very select few within the Mormon church, has become, to borrow from Nerd World, headcanon. The White Horse Prophecy has become headcanon within certain fringe groups within Mormonism. Though there has been some presidents and prophets later on who took the idea of the white horse prophecy and expanded upon it, it is not an officially held theology of the Mormon Church. And as a result, anybody who is Mormon who holds this prophecy is considered a fringe group. The Mormon Church distanced themselves from the Bundys. They're not like, they do not claim them at all. This is, we are in fringe territory, even with the Mormons right now. And as you can guess, yes, the Bundys hold the White Horse prophecy and basically saw this moment and an additional moment, this moment when they are on a, when they're on their compound being or on their ranch and having this showdown with the U.S. government. They see this moment and an additional moment a few years later as their White Horse moment. Bundy believed, the head patriarch of the Bundy family believed that they were going to be the white horses to defend the Constitution. And what's wacky about all of this, go with me on this part, folks. With Mormonism, we have an American Christian cult that is holding to a fringe group within it. This fringe group believes that they are the saviors of the Constitution and the ones who are going to turn America back to God. Folks, welcome to Mormon Christian nationalism. Not that Mormonism already didn't have a nice little Christian nationalistic blend to it, but welcome to rather Mormon Christian nationalism. They are the defenders of the Constitution. So yes, there was a political justification for the Bundy family. I guess I should put justification in quotes for doing what they did, sticking it to the U.S. government, because who's the U.S. government to tell them what to do? But there was also a religious reason as well. The fulfillment of the White Horse prophecy. And I did say that this is fringe, but maybe not necessarily as small circle fringe as like maybe some fundamental circles, FLDS circles within Mormonism. Because basically, if you want the tell, if you want to know if somebody, especially within the political arena, is holding to the White Horse prophecy, then you have to listen to one very important phrase. The Constitution is hanging by a thread. That was not, I said that earlier, and it sounds very benign, right? It sounds just like we say that about other things. My sanity is hanging by a thread at this point with this year. But it is actually that phrase specifically, the Constitution, the American Constitution is hanging by a thread. If you hear someone like Glenn Beck, for example, say that phrase, that is a tell that that individual holds to this view of the White Horse prophecy. Welcome to Bundyville, a place of fringe Mormon theology that motivates individuals to take a stand against the U.S. government in hopes to also somehow protect the U.S. Constitution and redeem America back to God. This is Mormon Christian nationalism. And although it's one of those things where, at least for me, because again, I'm here in the Midwest, I can go, that's over there, folks. That's way over there. I don't have to think about it. Here's the thing. There are Mormon political commentators, as I've said, that also make reference to the White Horse prophecy, but also it gets wackier. That's it for season one. That's really it when it comes to season one of Bundyville. That's like very strictly religious speaking that I was like, okay, yeah, we got to talk about this. And then I was an idiot and I listened to season two. It's a wonderful series, but I listened to season two and I was like, oh, it gets worse. And it doesn't stay Mormon either. No, we're just going to get really bad. It's going to get really bad. And not only does it get really bad, it branches out. It goes out further than just a corner of the West that I have never actually been to. And instead, it starts invading all different spheres of the United States. And now we need to like settle in and maybe spend some time with some other groups. This is still going to stay within the realm of being culty. It is still going to stay within the realm of being Christian nationalistic as well. And that's why I think we need to talk about it, because although right now I would say the fire for against Christian nationalism has kind of died down a little bit, there's other things pressing at the moment. I'm recording this just days after the motherless.com story came out. So there's other things on people's minds right now, justifiably so. But yeah, let's not lose sight of the Christian nationalism part, because in the end, I remember in that episode where I sat down to systematize Christian nationalism into two camps. By the time I will be finishing this run of episodes, we're going to have to run it back, because I think we already need to make some revisions. But that's it for today's episode. Thanks again for listening. And this episode does not do that series justice. So please, once again, go listen to Bundyville. There is a link to it in the description of this episode. You should also check out the other great shows here on the Andazown Ministries podcast network, like Your Matter Matters, Theology on the Rocks, and my sister show, Kung Fu Pizza Party, where I deliver high-flying action in 30 minutes or less and serve up some wisdom one slice at a time. And please rate and review this show wherever you get your podcasts. Pass this episode along to a friend. I already plugged the email. What else is there? Check out my YouTube channel, Studio 219, a place for faith and pop culture. That's it for me. We'll see you next time as our trip to Bundyville continues. Gonna take a slight detour next week as we're gonna refresh our memory on something. I need to refresh my memory a little bit on something in order to continue in our journey here in Bundyville. But until then, this is Brandon signing off, reminding you as always that theology is for everyone, so keep on studying.